The first all-women's team who ascended Denali were up against this.
And by then, we had sent men to the moon, and women had not stood on the highest points on Earth, which is amazing. If this wasn't that long ago, right? It's fairly modern history. But at the time, popular belief held that women were incapable of doing this without men's help. They couldn't withstand high altitudes or savage elements or carrying heavy loads. They were too physically and emotionally weak to handle all that.
That's Cassidy Randall. She tells us about the Denali Damsels, a group of intrepid women who proved everything the climbing community believed about women to be wrong. Her book is 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. Then we talk with journalist and author Omar El Akkad about his urgent and unflinching critique of empire, media, and the failures of mainstream liberalism, all seen through the lens of the genocide in Gaza. It's called One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In her book, 30 Below, author Cassidy Randall tells the gripping, true story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali in 1970. Facing extreme sexism, brutal conditions, and life-threatening storms, this pioneering team of climbers defied expectations and set a precedent for future generations of women in mountaineering. Randall shares the harrowing details of their climb, the deep social dynamics at play, and why this historic feat was largely forgotten until now. Cassidy Randall, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Wow, what a gripping account this book, 30 Below, was. The harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. So this happened in 1970. Denali is the highest point in North America. It's an incredible story featuring amazing characters, women who were strong, had fantastic endurance, obsessive commitment, maybe even a little craziness given the fantastically dangerous conditions they subjected themselves to. So first, tell us about the mountain, Denali. What were the conditions? What are the conditions that people face if they try to reach the peak?
So Denali scrapes the sky at over 20,000 feet. And while it's not the tallest mountain on Earth, you know, it's not as tall as the 7,000 and 8,000 meter peaks in the Himalaya. It is one of the biggest mountains on Earth. So because it rises from a plateau on the Alaskan tundra that sits at just 2,000 feet, means that Denali rises 18,000 feet from its base, which is 6,000 more feet than Everest rises from its base. And so what that means is that climbers have to be on the mountain for longer to acclimatize to that incredible altitude gain, which means that they have to go slowly so that their bodies can get used to less oxygen in the air the further you grow up. And what that also means is being on the mountain for longer subjects them to these wild weather patterns that hit Denali that are unique to where it sits. So because it's the highest polar mountain and it sits close to the coast, it gets hit with these quicksilver fast, bitingly cold storms out of nowhere. And it is constantly cold on top of the mountain, just absolutely freezing temperatures, you know, 20 to 40 degrees below, winds of more than 70 miles an hour on a regular basis. And because it sits so far north on the 63rd parallel, while it's not as high as Everest, that location means that its air is just as thin as Everest in terms of where the oxygen is. So not an easy mountain to climb.
No, it is not. In fact, the mountain has claimed over 100 lives since 1903. And there was a particularly notable tragedy in 1967, which you kind of begin the book with, because one of the main characters in your book, Grace Homan, basically was on the mountain when that happened. So what did happen?
That 1967 incident is still the single biggest tragedy to have ever hit Denali at the time of my writing of this book. So in 1967, Grace Homan, an Alaskan mountaineer and doctor, was the only woman on an expedition heading for the summit of Denali. And they were little more than midway up the mountain when this storm broke over the top, and it trapped them in their camp where they were midway up the mountain. And when the storm had lifted just enough, they saw these figures coming down the mountain. And it was part of this party, the Wilcox expedition, who they knew were ahead of them on the mountain. And they go up and they meet this distressed party. And Joe Wilcox, who was the leader, said, "We have members of our party up on the top who stayed on top to summit. We haven't heard from them. They're seven men. We haven't heard from them for days. We had to descend because we were in such poor health from being up there for so long." And Grace was a member of the Alaska Rescue Group, as were some other members of the expedition that she was on. And Grace, unfortunately, was turned back in this crux moment that ends up being some really heavy stakes for her wanting to leave this all-women's expedition later. She's turned back. The rest of that expedition goes up after the storm has lifted to find that all seven men have died. And this storm was so intense that winds were estimated at 300 miles an hour on the summit. And that is not a typo.
It's incredible. I mean, that's like 100 miles more than a Category 5 hurricane.
It's sort of impossible to imagine what that would have been like.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this had something to do with her plans to lead an all-women's ascent of Denali. First, talk about the conditions that faced women in this very, very male sport at the time.
I love this question because I have so many outrageous anecdotes about what women used to face in the mountains. But first, context is so important here because this was 1970. And by then, we had sent men to the moon and women had not stood on the highest points on Earth, which is amazing. If this wasn't that long ago, right? It's fairly modern history. But at the time, popular belief held that women were incapable of doing this without men's help. They couldn't withstand high altitudes or savage elements or carrying heavy loads. They were too physically and emotionally weak to handle all that. So there are just some wild anecdotes. Like, for example, in 1961, which was just 9 years before Grace Homan led this climb, Irene Miller, who was an accomplished American alpinist, went to Makalu Base Camp in the Himalaya with her husband, who was on Sir Edmund Hillary's expedition up that mountain, hoping to join the expedition. Again, she's an accomplished alpinist. Hillary not only forbids her from the expedition, one of the members of his team says that if she wants to join, she ought to be willing to sleep with all the men on the team, as in have sex with. And remember, she went to base camp with her husband. So it wasn't just these narratives of the fact that women were weaker. Anytime a woman failed in the mountains on a high profile climb, it was just more evidence that they were incapable of doing this. It was these other sexist barriers that existed.
Exactly. Now, there was another reason why Grace wanted to summit Denali, and that had something to do with losing the love of her life. Is that right?
Yes. So not only before she leads this 1970 expedition, in the 3 years essentially leading up to this 1970 expedition, she is turned back on two expeditions on Denali, and then she wants to join an expedition to Dalagiri 1 in the Himalaya, which is at the time was widely considered the hardest 8,000 meter peak to climb. And her husband, Vin Homan, who was a really well-known Alaskan mountaineer, was on that expedition. The leader of that expedition had asked Vin to help him find qualified team members. Vin puts Grace forward because she's incredibly qualified, has climbed all over the world, has soloed several first ascents, and she's a doctor, which is really useful on these expeditions. And the team leader, though, writes back and says Grace must be suffering from illusions of grandeur and light experience and refuses to allow her. And then, heartbreakingly, Ben never comes back from the Himalaya. He dies on an avalanche on the mountain. And Grace is just laden with what becomes this really intense and metastasizing survivor's guilt, and thinking, what if I had been there? Could I have made different decisions where he wouldn't have died? What if women had been on the expedition at all? Would different decisions be made? Which leads her, all of these factors, to say, what if an all-women's team climbed a mountain? What would happen?
Let's talk about, you know, I said before, they may have a little bit of craziness. For me, it is unimaginable to put myself in the kind of risk and extreme discomfort that you describe so vividly in this book, Cassidy Randall in 30 Below. Talk about the psychology of mountain climbers. And there's even a scientific basis for people who do this. Tell us what that is.
I love talking about this. And I have a little imposter syndrome because I'm not an alpinist. I did not climb Denali for this book. I have done some high altitude pursuits, and I know my body does not do well at altitude, but I am a backcountry skier. I dabble in ski mountaineering and a lot of other mountain pursuits. And so I've been interested in this for a while. Why do we do this? And there is a few scientific studies that have isolated this gene called DRD4, and it's associated with explorers. It's called the explorer gene. So people who seek novelty, who want to try new things, who want to go to far-flung locations. So partially it's science, but a lot of people who do the things like this team of women did will tell you that it's not science, that there's something more ephemeral to it, that there is this meditation in having the simplicity of all you have to do every day is move upward, keep yourself alive, and have the single goal. And there's such an ultimate presence to that, that people meditate for hours, lifetimes to achieve, right? And you can achieve it just by being on the side of this mountain and everything that goes with that, of course. And there is also this presence in being sort of at the hands of the elements, where there's so much risk involved, where what keeps you safe is your own capability and your knowledge of conditions, and sometimes some unpredictable elements too, right? You can't control everything out there. And that sort of proximity to the natural world and how volatile it can be also is this ultimate presence. And people who have walked this line, and even people who, you know, you go out to do some things that don't involve quite, you know, the risk of dying, but still there might be some sort of physical risk involved. And you're just so close to the natural world, where there's this awe, this self-transcending awe, so many studies that talk about what awe does for us, that even though you are so close to death, like these women were at times, it's the most alive that you ever feel.
Mm. Well, I must have a homebody gene.
Which is also very valuable.
Yeah. But it was just an incredible account to read. So now tell us about the other women as well. I mean, that first expedition that we spoke about, where those seven climbers died, part of the reason was a social breakdown in the group. So social relationships are absolutely key in this expedition, and also key to creating some danger within it. So first tell us about these women, the other women there is, apart from Grace Homan, Margaret Young, Dana Isherwood, Arlene Blum, Margaret Clark, and Faye Kerr. And they called themselves the Denali Damsels. So start right there.
I do love that these were all really accomplished mountaineers, women who had a lot of experience. And if they didn't have a lot of experience, they substituted quite a lot of strength with it. And they chose this name, the Denali Damsels, for the irony of it. And so they're stationary on, where they would sort of send that out to get sponsors and on their applications to the park. Their official name was the International McKinley Women's Team. And then in this cursive underneath, it said Denali Damsels. And there's this great correspondence between Arlene and Grace, this letter correspondence, where Arlene writes that Margaret Young came up with this name and Arlene loved it because it conjured this image of just walking daintily up this savage mountain with parasols, right? And Grace reads it and laughs out loud. And they choose to use this name. And I think that that's kind of a testament to who these women were, that they were trying to do something that everybody thought was impossible and had the ability to kind of laugh about it. I mean, that's pretty impressive. But one thing that drew me to this narrative was that these women were all so different, very different, all the way from age. Grace was 44, 45 when she led this expedition. Arlene was 23, 24. And from geography, Faye was Australian. Margaret Clark was from New Zealand. They were from Alaska and California. But what was really interesting and sort of a uniting factor was that they were these women who were really used to navigating men's worlds already and not just as rare female climbers, but they were doctors, chemists, physicists, geologists, pilots, mechanics, which is really amazing in 1970. And what I also love about this is that in terms of social dynamics, they knew that they would be subject to scrutiny as sort of the first all women's team to do this, right? And that although social dynamics had broken apart the Wilcox expedition, that was that fated expedition in 1967 on Denali, where those seven men died, the Wilcox expedition had been excoriated for its social dynamics that led to that tragedy. And the women were pretty aware that they would be sort of excoriated for catfights, right? So it could be the least little thing, and it would be blown up. Whatever, failure perceived or real would really be magnified. And the social dynamics then that are really interesting is that these women, none of them follow this typical hero's journey that we like to associate with our cultural narratives, right? There's no clear-cut saints and sinners. They don't all emerge friends at the end the way that we want, or the companions in our great tales to emerge. And that has to be okay because they are real and complicated people.
Yes, but those social dynamics led to some real danger. First of all, there were some key tensions between Dana and Grace. And Grace herself was not in the, well, she was in good physical shape, I guess, when you start, but she was quite susceptible to altitude sickness. And that ended up being an issue. Now, I don't know if you don't want to, any spoilers, or you think that people know what happened well enough. Do you feel comfortable talking about what happened on the mountain?
Yeah, let's talk about it a little bit. It's funny, I've been on other podcasts where the interviewers sort of give away the entire book, and then you think, oh, nobody's going to want to read this. But I do think that there are a few different climaxes throughout the book, but one of them is this escalating tension between Dana and Grace being two totally different personalities. And Dana, one of her stakes, wanting to be to climb the mountain, get it done and get back home to her newlywed husband because she was so in love, which is such an interesting foil to Grace, who's just heartbroken and carrying this grief up the mountain because she just lost her husband, right? But Grace, having, and I don't think she disclosed this to her teammates, but in her 20s, when she was getting her medical degree, she was exposed to so many communicable diseases. She had two bouts of tuberculosis that impacted her lungs, and that meant that she needed longer to be on the mountain. And so Dana wants to move fast, Grace wants to move slow. And they just were two really strong women who were like these two diametric forces. There was that going on. And then you also had Grace as leader and Arlene as deputy leader. And two different forces there, where Arlene was very much a peacekeeper and young and didn't trust in her own ability to lead yet. And Grace being so experienced and really strong-willed. And so when we get to this point on the mountain where Grace essentially puts them all in a survival situation where they could all die because she refuses essentially to turn back when she's suffering from this terrifyingly acute altitude sickness. There are all of these like roiling social dynamics happening where the team doesn't necessarily make the decisions you want them to make.
And one of the women was quite intriguing. You call her MY, that's Margaret Young, to distinguish her from Margaret Clark. She almost seems like she's on the autism spectrum because she was so disconnected from the group.
I think that Margaret Young happens to be one of my favorite characters because she's such an eccentric. And I think that she was very likely just a genius. And whatever kind of, you know, different social skills come with that, the way a genius's brain works. Margaret Young was definitely on the spectrum of those social skills. Yeah, absolutely, totally disconnected.
Yeah, she's really fascinating. So this was the first ascent, and yet it was barely remarked upon. There was no national news of it. First of all, why do you think that's true? Why did so few people know about this ascent?
I have a couple speculations, and I think one of them was the timing of it. So this climb unfolded just 2 months before August of 1970, when the women's strike for equality down Fifth Avenue, where all of these women linked arms and walked down Fifth Avenue, put second wave feminism on the national map. And so this climb unfolded in sort of the obscure infancy of that movement. And I think potentially, had it happened maybe the following year, it might have been one of those stories of lone heroines that movement was really looking for to help add momentum. But as it was, it was sort of faded into obscurity. The other thing is that even in 1970, there still persisted in these pockets of the world that any climb or route that a woman had achieved without a man's help was deemed too easy for men to do again. And this was Denali, right? So I wonder, were there people who didn't want to talk about that? Or, I mean, there could also be the fact that we tend to focus on failure more often to sort of prop up whatever narrative it serves us to prop up, because boundary-breaking successes serve to change a popular narrative that is not always very welcome, right? And so what's really interesting is 2 years after this climb in 1972, Arlene reads in the LA Times with astonishment about the first all-female ascent of Denali. And it is this Japanese group of women. And the LA Times covers it, I wonder, because they supposedly made it to the summit, but three of the women died on the way down and their bodies were found at 15,000 feet. And the climb only, this article in LA Times only mentions the women who died, and it didn't even talk about the survivors. I had to go and search for that. So that's an example of the fact that the failure was more spotlighted than any successes.
So nonetheless, this amazing ascent of the real first woman ascent of Denali that happened in 1970, you say did have a profound legacy. What was that?
I think we're even still seeing what that legacy was. And in the sort of immediate spheres, there were local newspapers that covered this in the Bay Area, where several of the women were from, and Anchorage. Margaret Clark wrote some pieces in the Christchurch Press about it right off the bat. And so these women were influencing their close personal spheres, even if it didn't make national news, right? That they were just matter-of-factly doing these things that people thought were impossible for women to do. And in that, you know, directly, they were also training the next generation of climbers. And so Margaret Young really taught Annie Whitehouse to climb, who was one of the first women on Everest, American women on Everest. Margaret Clark had some influence with Lydia Brady, who was the New Zealand climber who in the 1980s became the first woman at all to summit Everest without oxygen. And so now Arlene, who has just an incredible resume in mountaineering and alpinism, is probably one of the biggest influences on the women's climbing world in modern history. So that climb for her cut her teeth on leadership, right? And a few years later, she would go on to lead the first all-women's climb to Annapurna in the Himalaya, which is a wildly savage mountain. And she wrote about that as well. So I think that sometimes it takes us a while to see the bigger impact, but immediately these women had an impact on their communities right off the bat.
Well, as I said, it's a gripping account. I read it almost cover to cover in one go. The descriptions are just amazing, and it's been a thrill to talk with you, Cassidy Randall, about 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Cassidy Randall is an award-winning author whose stories about adventure, the environment, and the West have appeared in Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, National Geographic, and other venues. She writes an adventure travel column for Forbes and also wrote the sports book, The Hard Parts. Next up, a writer breaks up with the American myth over Gaza. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. As Israel breaks a ceasefire to unleash more death and destruction in Gaza, a new book lays out the stark proposition that one day everyone will have always been against this. That's the title of Omar El-Akkad's blistering critique of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the larger forces that have allowed it to proceed unchecked. In this powerful and deeply personal work, El-Akkad examines the brutal realities of empire, the failures of liberalism, and the complicity of those who remain silent in the face of the atrocities. Through reflections on Gaza, U.S. foreign policy, and his own journey as a journalist covering war and protest, El-Akkad exposes the cracks in the so-called free world. We last spoke with El-Akkad in 2022 about his novel, What Strange Paradise. Now join us for an urgent conversation about power, language, and the responsibility to bear witness. Omar El-Akkad, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is such an important book. One day, everyone will have always been against this. This title really struck me before even reading the book, because that's what I've been thinking since it became so clear that Israel was engaged in a genocide against the Palestinians. So tell us about your thinking behind this title.
So the title comes from this tweet I put out in October of 2023. I'm not much of a social media guy. I've stopped altogether since then. But at the time, you know, I post once a month or something, and I didn't think much of it. It just seemed to me a particularly self-evident thing that when it's too late to do anything about any of this, it'll just be acceptable in polite society to talk about how you've always been against it. It ended up gaining traction, but I was working on the book independent of that. And it was only after the manuscript was, a first draft of the manuscript was completed, that one of my editors suggested using that as the title. And so one of the things I've been trying to do in almost every interview is try to convince people that I didn't just take a tweet and stretch it out to 200 pages. I promise that's not what was going on. But for me, it was a function of, I think, pattern recognition. I think now of all the literary festivals I go to that start with a land acknowledgement, or the fact that it's very difficult for me to find somebody who wasn't always against South African apartheid. I don't think this is something that's going to happen next week, but I think perhaps towards the end of my life, I might see something similar here.
Well, I hope it comes a lot sooner than that. In this book, you have two narrative threads. One is talking about what's going on in Gaza, the contemporary assault and the genocide that is happening there. And the other thread is your own story, coming to this country and becoming a journalist. Talk about the evolution of your own understanding of the empire, because this book is very centered on the empire of neoliberalism, the global economic order. You say that there were deep, ugly cracks in the bedrock of this thing called the free world, and yet you believe the cracks could be fixed, that the thing was salvageable until the fall of 2023. So what changed for you?
I mean, I think one of the things about this book is that obviously I wouldn't have started writing it were it not for the slaughter in Gaza. But, you know, Palestinians can tell their own stories and have been telling their own stories. This for me is very much a book about my anchoring towards the West, which has been going on for the vast majority of my life. There's a reason I sound the way I do. There's a reason that I am culturally fluent here. And when most people who are born and raised in this part of the world talk to me, I generally don't feel far away. And so in a sense, I think for me, this book is about this notion of the negative space of becoming that kind of person, the things that I chose not to think about. And this is a particularly significant kind of self-indictment because it's not like I was sitting around during those years at a great distance from the things I'm talking about. I was a journalist. I was in Afghanistan. I was in Guantanamo Bay. I was in Ferguson, Missouri, covering the protests there. I saw some of these cracks up close. I think the difference over the last year and a half is that there's a kind of immediacy and intimacy and complicity that, and perhaps this is a function of my own naivete, I hadn't felt before. It's a very jarring thing to witness a genocide being live streamed and have your politicians and elected representatives tell you that this is a good thing and that you're a bad person if you oppose it, and know that you are paying for this, right? I'm paying for those bombs. I'm killing those kids. That's me. And so I think the immediacy of it, the intimacy of it, and my own complicity in it has forced me to think about the kind of human being I am with relationship to this part of the world in a very different way. And that's essentially what I think this book is about. I know it barges in through the door pretending to be a series of very incendiary arguments. But at its core, I think it's a book about uncertainty. I've become unanchored from the thing I've oriented myself towards for the majority of my life, and I don't know what I am on the other side of that.
Yeah, I'd like to pick that up a little bit later, but first, so that our listeners can really understand the arguments that you lay out, you know, I think it might be dawning on a lot of people that the system we live under, this neoliberal capitalism, has never really been about democracy for all. And you say this is the account of a fracture, a breaking away from the notion that the polite Western liberal ever stood for anything at all. So you've talked about the breaking away part. Talk about the liberal never standing for anything at all.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the ways in which I've come to think about any society I live in, and I've lived in a bunch of very different ones, is in terms of the sort of reward-punishment equilibrium. You know, here's the ways in which you're punished for stepping out of line, and here are the ways in which you are rewarded for remaining in line. And I see this through the prism of my own personal experience. You know, I've been rewarded greatly for falling in line, for being the kind of human being I am. You know, I have relatives who have similar names, who look the same religion, who get dragged into secondary every time they try to cross a border because they don't sound like me, right? And so one of the things I was thinking about when I was thinking about sort of mainstream liberalism, particularly in this country, particularly in the United States, is the sense that there is kind of a great distance between the performance of virtue and the pragmatic reality. You know, you wake up in the morning and you watch a State Department press secretary talk about the deep care this country has for a population that is undergoing immense bombardment while at the same time funding that bombardment. And you can't kind of look away from the chasm between those two things. You know, when I talked to people early on about this book when I was writing it, the biggest discrepancy in reaction wasn't ideological. It wasn't between liberals and conservatives. It wasn't religious or ethnic. It was generational. I would talk to folks older than me about this book, and they would say, you know, you probably shouldn't write this book. Because again, they'd become attuned to a certain kind of punishment reward structure. and they were thinking about the punishment. Whereas when I talk to people younger than me, they were completely unfazed by anything that's in this book. And I think that's because for them, the reward punishment equilibrium is breaking down completely. There used to be a time where if you kept your head down and you just looked away, the reward was, you know, a house in the suburb and a two-car garage and a life that was materially better than the previous generation. And for them, all of that is falling apart. And so I think it relates to this notion of what mainstream liberalism can offer. And if you have to contend with this massive discrepancy between what is said and what is done, what are you getting in return?
And you also talk about the fortress of language. I think that fortress that Noam Chomsky talks about, manufacturing consent, I mean, that is breaking down with younger people, although there are plenty of people my age, and I'm a senior, who people I know who stand out on the street every Sunday and demonstrate in support of Palestinian rights. And they're all old folks, but I think you're right about the generational difference. So talk about that fortress of language and how that language is necessary for liberals.
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes from my time, obviously, as a writer, which is what I do for a living, but also when I was a journalist. I tend to think of all stories, again, in terms of this distance, this gap between two things. The first is how you would write that story, how you would tell that story in a vacuum, were there no external pressures. And the other is how you actually do write or tell that story with those pressures in place. And I think this refers to some of the stuff that Chomsky brings up in Manufacturing Consent, which is the notion, for example, in the media of the pressures related to loss of access. You write a bad story about a CEO, you don't have access to that CEO or that company again, or the pulling of advertising, or all of these forces that shouldn't have any kind of say in how a story is told, but do. And so when you look at something like an Israeli soldier killing a four-year-old girl, shooting her in a car, and then the headline or the way it's presented is something like, bullet finds its way into van and hits a four-year-old young lady. What you are witnessing, in addition to many other grotesqueries involved in that particular construction, is a vast distance between how that story would be told absent external pressure and how that story is actually being told. And so a lot of the way the book thinks about language, and I think about language in the book, is about that gap, because I think the wider it is, the less healthy the state of a society's discourse is.
Yes, you call it the heightened derangement of language for the purpose of sanitizing violence. But it also extends so farther afield than that. I mean, talk about how terrorism itself is defined.
Yeah, I mean, the first big story that I had when I was hired on at my newspaper, it was a terrorism case. It was the biggest terrorism case in Canadian history at the time. And when I say that a lot of this book is self-indictment, I mean, this is the kind of stuff I'm talking about. I covered that story, and I covered it well. We won a national newspaper award. It made my career. And one of the things I find fascinating about it is that when I was working on it, I was thinking of it as a crime story. Those crimes happen all the time. We cover, there are crime reporters. There are reporters who spend their entire career covering crime. But what happened in this case was that there was a kind of social language that was overlaid on top of this. And as far as I could tell, the central purpose of that language, which in some cases was literally linguistic, it was how you describe the suspects and how you describe the crime and so on and so forth, but also a kind of language of permission, which is to say that because this is terrorism, because we have deemed it terrorism, here are the rules that don't apply anymore. Here's the way that we're going to treat this case that we would never, ever do if this was another type of crime story. And maybe you believe that terrorism deserves its entire new set of rules, but you see this kind of derangement at its logical extreme in a place like Guantanamo Bay, for example, where, you know, you have an ad hoc legal system that is being made up on the spot precisely to get convictions against a certain group of people. This is what the word terrorism is doing. It's allowing for a setting aside of conventions and rules and ways of doing things in search of an end goal. I don't know that there's anything more damaging for a legal system than to create a way of thinking about a crime and a way of thinking about an allegation that works backwards from an intended outcome. That to me is the exact opposite of what an actual justice system should be doing. And I think that's going to be the longest lasting consequence of the kind of language, social, linguistic, or otherwise, that we have basically dressed up that word in.
And it's already, I mean, the terrorism enhancements in sentences being applied so inappropriately. Or to think of, for example, the killing of the activists in Atlanta at the Atlanta Forest. You know, the whole organization that's trying to defend a forest being called a terrorist. It is terrifying. And then you point out also other rights that are being eroded in this way. For example, you know, the right for people to decide whether they're going to boycott a product from Israel. So talk about, you know, how that has developed as well, the forbidding of people being able to exercise the First Amendment rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most dangerous things we've decided to allow as a society, and I say we in the grandest possible sense, many, many people have stood up to this sort of thing, and nonetheless, it has happened anyway, is this fantasy that all of these moments in which we strip ourselves of rights, in which we sort of limit freedom of expression, in which we limit freedom to protest, freedom of dissent, all of these things that in the national mythology we hold up in the highest regard, that it's going to remain temporary and that it's only going to apply to a certain subset of human beings that we already consider subhuman. So who cares? Let's do this. And it's never that. Even if it was just that, it would make it no less evil, but it never is. The light armored vehicles that I saw in Afghanistan with the machine gun turret on top, that I'm sure killed countless of Afghanistani folks who got too close, I saw them again in Ferguson, Missouri. And it shouldn't be the case that I'm presenting it this way, right? Because effectively what I'm saying is, yeah, the bad thing happened to people who don't matter, but you better be careful because soon they'll matter, they'll happen to people who matter. And I understand that that is a construction from within the heart of the empire that shows you the kind of person I am. But it's nonetheless a function of countering the central lie we tell ourselves, which is the bad thing is just happening to those people over there and it will stay in those confines. It never will. It never will. And so you see all of these new, legislation, these new rules being passed, these new punishments being handed out. And some of them are on their face absurd. You can try very hard to punish someone for something they don't do or something they don't buy, but it's an increasingly difficult thing. And if you think that it's being applied in this one case and that'll be the end of it, I and certainly recent history has some bad news.
Yep, say more about that.
So when we were in Guantanamo, we would get these court documents. There was a sort of ad hoc court system in place to try the prisoners in the war on terror. And when we get court documents, they'd be subject to all kinds of redactions. So you'd get this piece of paper that looks like a chessboard. It's just got black lines and squares all over the place. And the argument was that this was a state of heightened national security. And so, we need to make redactions here that otherwise, in other cases, we wouldn't, and so on and so forth. And I don't think a word of that was ever true, but it established a precedent, right? There's a moment in the book where I talk about Muhammadu Slahi's diary. He was held in Guantanamo for years, and he kept this diary, and eventually it was published. And the first edition of that book went through that censorship process. And there's a scene in that book where he's being interrogated very, very harshly. And there's obviously more than one person in the room, but only certain pronouns are blacked out. And you look closely, and the pronouns that are blacked out are the female pronouns. The censor doesn't want you to know that there was a female soldier in that room. I have a hard time believing that there's a sort of formal national security case to be made in that sense. But every one of these things establishes a precedent. This is how we do this now. And so when you establish legislation against boycotting, for example, you are establishing precedent. And why can't we use this in other cases where somebody is saying something that the state doesn't like? I mean, you generally watch this in slow motion under Democratic administrations, but under this present administration, you are going to watch it at a much, much faster speed. All of these precedents that we've allowed to be established are now going to be used across the board. As you and I are speaking, there are migrants being shipped off to Guantanamo Bay, which brings the use of that base full circle, I suppose, but none of this stuff happens if we don't allow those precedents to come into play.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're listening to a conversation I recorded in late February with Omar El-Akkad about his book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. In this book, you spend a lot more time critiquing the liberals, critiquing the centrists, than attacking the right wing. And you already spoke about the insincere expressions of concern for Palestinians by the Biden administration while they bankroll their butcher. First of all, why do you choose the liberals for more critique than the right wing? And then do you think that their hypocrisy might have cost them the election?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because on its face, it's a patently unreasonable position to take, right? In almost every way, the derangement of the Republican Party and the far right in this country is on display in so many more grotesque ways. And, you know, I should be more mad at them. And I've spent a lot of my career writing about that derangement. You know, in the United States, I think one of the central difficulties of political discourse is trying to get past this notion that there exists a right-wing party and a left-wing party in the United States. And by any sort of assessment, there is no right-wing and left-wing party. There's a far-right party, and there's a sort of center-right party. But I was one of those people up until very recently who would pick up a ballot, would look for whoever has the R next to their name, and then vote for whoever has the D next to their name because, you know, lesser of two evils. And I think something about the last year and a half has no longer allowed me to retreat into that particular kind of cowardice. I know that I should be more angry at the far right in this country. I understand that, and God knows I am. I am deeply angry. And what we're about to see over the next 4 years is going to be horrific in so many different ways. My anger at the Democratic Party, at mainstream liberalism, is tinged with something else, is tinged with a set of betrayal and frustration, because the degree of apathy and the degree of impotence that is required to lose power to a party like this is mind-boggling. You're up against one of the worst human beings to ever run for president, and your base is begging you to do something about an ongoing slaughter, to do something about climate change that threatens whether our children and grandchildren are going to be able to live on this planet, to do something. And your response can fit on a lawn sign. And as a result, we're in the situation we're in. And I understand that there's a lot of people who are deeply angry at anyone who didn't vote Democrat because you got us into this mess, et cetera, and fine. But if consequences exist, then certainly it must be a two-way street. And there must be some consequences for the party that allowed this to happen through sheer apathy in the first place. I think that's why I spend a lot of time talking about liberalism and the failures of mainstream liberalism in this book, because that wasn't a sort of alien tribe to me. That was the thing I hung my hopes on, and now I can't do that anymore.
You characterize the position of those liberals as vote for the liberal, though he harms you, because the conservative might harm me too. And when it comes to climate change and in so many other ways, it's going to harm everyone. I argued with people that at least with the Biden administration or Kamala Harris, we could continue to fight. In other words, I would prefer Harris as an opponent than Trump. What do you say to that? Because I have to say, I found your arguments pretty compelling in this book.
Yeah, I don't think that I'm out to try and berate anyone for whoever they want to vote for. I come from a part of the world where if I had written this book, you know, if I had written my version of this book over there, you'd never hear from me again. And I'm not out to sort of tell someone this is how you need to vote. I think for me, the thing that comes up over and over again is the kind of really distressing poverty of opportunity implicit in that kind of argument. Like, you know, it's very difficult to make that argument and not use the phrase at least it'll be better than this. And it would be kind of nice if I didn't have to do that, right? If I wasn't just constantly voting against the worst thing, because that's effectively been the entirety of my political life as a voter in this country, is voting for the least worst thing. And there's two problems with that. The first is that you as a political party, as an entity, are tethering yourself to the worst thing. And so as it gets worse, so do you. You know, if Donald Trump wants to build 30 concentration camps for migrants along the border and the Democratic Party convinces him to settle for 15, that's not a victory to me. You know, it's better than the worst thing, I suppose. But then I guess the other part of it is just sometimes human beings hit a wall and can't perform relatively anymore. You know, relatively, everything you said makes perfect sense to me. But I draw an absolute line of genocide. And so I am unable to agree with you when I desperately want to, because everything you've said makes perfect sense. But sometimes you just hit absolute lines. And an entire system of pragmatic, you know, voting falls apart when you can no longer behave in that relativistic manner because something absolute has forced your hand.
Well, I guess for me, I have it has been decades since I've understood that the system is irrevocably unjust. And so for me, my life has been dedicated to trying to move to a different system, one that is just. And, you know, the question I struggle with is that as the system collapses around us, a collapse that I've seen since I was in my 20s, I knew it would come when I was involved in the anti-war movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement. You know, we understood what the empire was, and we understood how implacable it was. And it was the essential nature of this country. And it came right after the Civil Rights Movement, which also revealed the true nature of this country. So the question has always been for me, how do we create the new world within the ashes of the old? Of course, that world is collapsing ever more quickly now. And that is the question that remains. And you ask, what is your work for? And I would assume that your work is to make a better world. What's your thinking on where we go from here?
Yeah, I think there's an incredible sort of naivete implicit in one of the central theses of this book, which is, like you said, I mean, there are many, many people who've known for a very long time and who've been doing the work for a very long time. I suspect that every generation has its certain moments wherein that realization becomes too difficult to look away from. And maybe this happens to be one for me or for my generation or for generations younger than me. But certainly there's folks like yourself who've known this for a very long time and have been doing the work for a very long time. You know, as gloomy as so much of this book's sort of overarching thesis is, I think of it as an incredibly hopeful book, in large part because of what you've just spoken about. You know, as cynical as I've become about essentially every load-bearing institutional beam of the Western world, political, academic, cultural, you name it, I've been so inspired by what individuals are doing and what communities are doing and what people are doing in solidarity with one another, exactly the sort of stuff you're talking about and the sort of stuff that you're well-versed in. You know, I'm a guy who sits alone in a room in the forest out here in Oregon and writes for a living. I'm doing barely anything at all. And I keep going back to what I see every day, which is people chaining themselves to the gates of weapons manufacturers and having sit-ins at the university where the university administrators that are supposed to protect them are instead launching cops to tear gas them and brutalize them. I'm watching people show incredible displays of courage, and so that is giving me hope for a better world. in a more sort of pragmatic political sense, this is the first time in my lifetime where I have seen one of the most powerful political parties on earth actually suffer electoral consequences for its apathy towards a brutalized population on the other side of the planet that has no real capacity to directly vote someone out here. I'm seeing parties that are speaking out about this make inroads, granted at the lowest levels of politics, city councilor type levels, but that's where this stuff begins, right? It's not every 4 years we try to elect the right person president and then we whine about it for 4 years and repeat. At the local level, I'm seeing changes. And so all of these things are giving me hope. But I can't sit here and tell you that most days I don't wake up very, very dejected. There's so many people who didn't have to die, and there's so much carnage that didn't have to happen. This stuff is slow, but I watch what people are willing to do and what they're willing to risk, and I leech courage from that. And that gives me hope that something better is on the way. Maybe I'm being hopelessly optimistic, but sometimes that's not the worst thing.
Yeah, an author recently told me there's a difference between hope and optimism. Optimism thinks things are going to get better, but hope is always available for us to hope that things can get better and to do what we can to do that. And I want to say that I don't think you're doing much of nothing at all, because this book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, Omar El-Akkad, I think this book is so powerful, and I think it is going to have a huge impact. And I want to thank you so much for writing it. It is beautifully written, powerfully written, and I think it's a very, very important book.
Thank you so much. That's incredibly generous. And thank you for having me on. This was a pleasure.
Omar El-Akkad is an award-winning journalist and author of the novels American War and What Strange Paradise. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our conversation about What Strange Paradise. And finally, a note about the most serious threat to voting rights you've never heard of. It's the bill the House GOP is fast-tracking, called the SAVE Act. A bill that would require all Americans to provide a birth certificate, passport, or one of a very few other citizenship documents in person every time they register or re-register to vote. If enacted, it would devastate voter registration while disenfranchising tens of millions of eligible American citizens. And it would make it harder for women to vote if they've ever changed their name, for example, when they got married. Next week, we'll get the lowdown on this dangerous bill when we talk with poet and voting activist Catherine Levy about it. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.